Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's safe to say that George Washington is among the most important persons in American history. And it's also probably safe to say that George Washington is probably not as well understood as he should be. And there is one facet of George Washington's greatness that has been especially neglected. And that neglect has been rectified, at least to a point, by a very, very interesting new book called First Entrepreneur, How George Washington Built His and the Nation's Prosperity. It is the contention of the author, Edward G. Lengel, that George Washington was perhaps the greatest American businessman of any generation. He was exceptionally sharp in so many different respects, and that this sharp mind of a businessman, an entrepreneur, had a great deal to do with who George Washington was and with the way in which he led our fighting forces in the Revolutionary War and the way in which he led our nation as its first president. And this is, as I said, a often neglected facet of who George Washington was, but neglected no longer. The author of the book, Edward G. Lengel, is a professor at the University of Virginia and director of the Washington Papers Documentary Editing Project in Charlottesville, Virginia, and the author of General George Washington, A Military Life, and Inventing George Washington, America's Founder in Myth and Memory. This latest book, First Entrepreneur, is published by Da Capo Press. Edward G. Lengel, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm very excited about this. I'm curious to just know a little bit about this Washington Papers documentary editing project that is mentioned in your biography. Can you just say a word about what that is and what your role is in that project?
Well, sure. We've been around since 1968. The task of the project from the beginning was to identify and collect copies of every known letter to and from George Washington. They are scattered all over the world, and to transcribe, edit, and publish them in book form and now in digital form. So we have got up to 70 volumes now. We've got 8 years left to go before we're completely done with all of his correspondence. We're still working on the end of the Revolutionary War, but we've done most of his presidency. But a few years ago, we started a new venture, which was to do the same thing with all of Washington's financial papers, which had never been done before. So that's been an exciting new project.
Can you just explain what you said about 8 years remaining? What exactly do you mean by that, and how was that calculated?
Well, we've got 8 years to go before we finish everything. That means we'll be done in 2024. We're publishing about two volumes a year.
Oh, I see. So judging on the pace by which this work is being completed, right, you have about 8 years to go.
Yeah, that's right. We're quite close to the end. It's getting pretty exciting around here.
Right, I should think. And as far as you know, you have in hand just about everything that there is to have. I mean, in a sense, the discovery process is pretty much over by this point in terms of looking for Washington's papers and letters.
Actually, the discovery process is not over, and it probably won't be over in our lifetimes, because there's a fairly steady trickle of new documents that are appearing. Usually they're appearing in private hands, and in some cases I know of, literally popping up in people's attics. So when we hear about that, and we do try to find out, we try to get copies of them so we can be sure to add them to the collection.
Very good. As I mentioned, you've written two previous books about George Washington. So he is obviously somebody with whom you are deeply acquainted and have extensively researched. At what point did it become clear to you, and for what reason did it become clear to you, that the facet of Washington's life that you approach in First Entrepreneur had been neglected or maybe not fully appreciated?
It took me quite a while. I've been working with Washington's papers for 20 years now, and I'm a military historian by training, so I've really focused on the Revolutionary War papers and tried to learn more about him as a military commander. There is a lot to learn there still. But it was only really a few years ago when we began looking at the financial papers to publish them that I began to think about not just those papers, but how really finance and money and those considerations have informed his worldview in everything that he did. So it's been a pretty recent revelation for me.
Hmm. Before we dig into the essential content of your book, I want to ask you about something mentioned at the very front in the note on the text, in which you first of all mention the fact that that sometimes a bit of editing is sometimes in order when it comes to reproducing a letter that might have misspellings or other oddities that might make it kind of confusing to a modern day reader. And then you go on to talk a moment about the matter of currency. And I find this so fascinating because the matter of currency is of great importance at several points in this story. Explain why there is a bit of confusion that hangs over conversations about currency at this point in our history.
Well, currency is, especially in the period when the states were still colonies, is extremely confusing, and during the Revolutionary War as well. Because of the British colonial system, we were forced to mostly work with credit, and currency was very hard to come by, especially hard currency. As a result, what Americans used was a whole variety of different things. We had state currencies. Individual states or individual colonies in issuing their own paper currencies even after the states became independent. We had a national currency, we had continentals, but then we still had state currencies. Plus we used Spanish money, we used British money, we used French money, if it was hard currency, wherever we could find it. So if you look at George Washington's papers, he's talking about sometimes he used pound designations, other times dollars, other times even Spanish or Austrian types of currency. It's pretty bizarre. So you have to really study early American currency in order to have any understanding of value and worth. And plus, there was so much inflation that the value of paper currency was fluctuating wildly from one year to the next.
Hmm. You are writing about a period of our nation's history, I mean, and including that period before we really are a fully formed, cohesive nation. You're writing about a period of our history around which all kinds of myth has sprung up. I mean, and I'm not just talking about George Washington chopping down the cherry tree, but that we tend to think of the pivotal figures in our earliest history as being larger than life and driven by only the highest sorts of ideals. And, of course, the closer we look, the less that is what we see. You write, "This is a book about George Washington. It features a diverse and fascinating cast of characters, good, bad, and everywhere in between. Some worked in tandem for positive results. Others flew at each other's throats. What they shared in common was humanity with all its flaws and talents." That's a very even-handed way of describing it. But in fact, beyond Washington himself, a man of such sterling character, we really see something pretty disturbing, don't we, in terms of the kind of infighting and selfishness and short-sightedness with which he was contending on nearly a daily basis as he tried to lead this nation through these perilous days. I just wonder what it's like for you as a historian to look back at this part of our history and to reveal to the rest of us, in a sense, its unseemly underbelly.
You know, that's a great point that you raise. And when people think about what really goes into being a historian, and they think, oh, you have to study a lot or you have to memorize a lot of things, I think the most important thing to have is compassion when you're studying history. Compassion and empathy, which is to recognize that the people of the past are people just like us and that we're just like them. They have and share the same human flaws and humanity that all of us do. So when I look at history and I look at a period like this, you know, and for example, I see Hamilton and Jefferson at a time of great national need and a time of crisis when Washington is begging both of them just to try to get along. He recognizes that they're both brilliant. He tells them, we need both of you. Can you just try to work together? And they can't because they both despise each other. Each of them is convinced that the other one is trying to destroy the country deliberately. And they can't see beyond that. When I look at that, I see humanity. You know, I see two great men who nevertheless shared a weakness that they couldn't overcome, and we all suffered for it to some degree.
Hmm. I also find it really interesting, although by and large you are obviously a tremendous admirer of George Washington, with good reason, you're not afraid to describe every facet of him, including those facets of him which might seem to be less than monumentally great. For instance, early in the book, I think still in the introduction, you tell us in no uncertain terms, Washington was a crafty entrepreneur, a crafty and diligent entrepreneur. But it's kind of interesting. I just felt myself shiver a little bit as I first read those words, because we just don't necessarily want to think about the president's emblazoned on Mount Rushmore with adjectives like crafty. And yet there it is. It's one more way in which we can understand exactly who he was.
Well, Washington was a man of integrity, personal integrity, and I certainly admire him for that. But sometimes I think when we focus so much on his personal integrity, his great attributes, that he stiffens, he becomes a two-dimensional figure. And I think we need to see him more in the broad context of his humanity. Yes, he could be crafty. He could be angry. He could be jealous. He could be, there are even times in his life where he was seriously afraid or when he despaired. So I think that's part of seeing him as a human being. I mean, his craftiness and his entrepreneurial activities didn't mean so much that he was ruthless, but it meant that on the one hand, when he saw an opportunity for advantage, he would take it. And on the other hand, if a partnership or a business venture was not working out, he would drop it. He didn't feel that business was identical with charity. So if you have a partner who doesn't know what he's doing and he's going bankrupt, you don't surrender your own income in order to keep him propped up out of kind of a misguided sense of compassion. It's more of, he believed that self-interest really ultimately works for the national good.
Hmm. And ultimately, of course, the point is that everything that made him a great entrepreneur and a very successful businessman also served him well in sort of the public capacities with which we are best acquainted with Washington. But it's a facet of that, those leadership qualities that we just haven't maybe properly or fully considered until now.
I agree. There were times as president, as commander-in-chief, he had to be tough-minded. He had to cut to the chase, and he had to make the tough decisions. If he had been afraid to do that, I think we would all have suffered for it.
We're speaking with Edward G. Lengle about his new book called First Entrepreneur, How George Washington Built His and the Nation's Prosperity. Chapter one of your book is called Family Fortunes, and I'm so glad that you outline for us in rich detail sort of the history of the Washington family. Explain where their fortune came from.
Well, the first Washington was a guy named John Washington who came to the country in the 1650s thinking he was going to buy a bunch of tobacco and take it back to England, but then his ship sank and he decided to stay in Virginia. He and his son and his grandson, who was George Washington's father, all built their fortunes on the one hand by purchasing, acquiring, and developing land. And on the other hand, all three of them made very good marriages. So they brought into the family extensive land holdings and wealth from their spouses, which they were very careful stewards of. They were not just acquiring and piling up and then rubbing their hands with glee and thinking about how rich they were. When they brought in new acquisitions, they were very careful to preserve and to develop and improve them. So all of them, in that sense, were fairly crafty. They looked for advantage and tried to develop those advantages.
Mm-hmm. I appreciated especially the way in which we come to understand George Washington's own parents, Augustine Washington and his mother, Mary Washington. And you talk about what a wonderful couple they were. I mean, with each other's strengths really, in a sense, building the other. And it's especially interesting how you help maybe reshape what our impressions might be of Mary Washington, and reshape what our imagination might be in terms of what the typical early 18th century homemaker might do in a household like the Washingtons. Set us straight. What would somebody like Mary Washington be busy doing on a daily basis?
So the first thing I would say about their marriage, and this was true of all the Washington marriages in George's line, is that they were superb partnerships, is that both husband and wife had the same ends in view, which was to preserve and develop their estates and pass them on down intact to their children. So Mary Ball Washington, George Washington's mother, one of the reasons that Augustine, George's father, was attracted to her was that he saw her as a strong-minded woman who didn't mess around and was a great manager. That when he was away on business, which he often was, even overseas, that she could take charge of the entire estate and run it. And that didn't mean, as we think of, you know, the 1950s housewife, you know, working in the home and preparing dinner and washing dishes and ironing clothes.
Baking pies.
Yeah, exactly, and baking pies. It was much more than that. She had to take charge of a whole household and estate. In the case of the Washingtons in Virginia, that meant managing all the daily business activities, the workers, including the enslaved people who were on the estate, allocating labor, deciding what the big projects would be on the fields from day to day, managing trade, dealings with merchants, and all the rest. So women in that station of life had to be strong-minded, and that Mary was very strong-minded.
You tell us that George, young George, had two primary influences in his life, and they were his mother, Mary, maybe partly because his father was not always around and then died at a fairly young age. The other primary influence of young George was his older half-brother, Lawrence. And it is so intriguing to think about these two being the two great influences on his young life because they were so different from each other. Tell us about his half-brother, Lawrence, and the way in which he figured very prominently in shaping how George saw the world.
Lawrence was the opposite of George's mother, in that George's mother was all about thrift, all about diligence, determination, hard work, avoiding debt, that she passed that down to George. Whereas Lawrence was, I don't think really a ne'er-do-well is fair, but he was much more about enjoying life, taking things as you found them. He liked to tell stories. He liked social connections. And in that, he was a great counterbalance to George's mother, because Lawrence would take George around and introduce him to people, teach him how to carry himself well in society, how to dress well, and he also fed him on dreams. I think in some ways, George, to be as successful as he was as an entrepreneur, he also had to be a dreamer. And Lawrence was a dreamer, and he taught George to dream of big things. Lawrence also, more practically, introduced George to the Fairfax family, the most powerful family in Virginia, one of the most powerful families in North America. And it was those connections that helped get George on his way.
You tell us that George, throughout his life, would bemoan his lack of formal education and in some ways, you know, really diligently work to compensate for that. But you also say that he received education in other ways that maybe proved to be every bit as helpful to him in his future ventures as maybe more formal education might have provided. First of all, what ended up limiting his formal education, and what were the ways in which he was able to compensate for that?
Well, his father died when George was only 11, and we don't know if he would have been sent to England for an education if his father had lived, but in any case, that put paid to that, and he had to be educated at home. His mother didn't think she could afford to send him off to college. So the result of that was he worked with tutors, and he also educated himself, and he focused on more practical things, such as geometry, accounting, mathematics, hands-on practical learning, how to manage estates, how to work with tools, to work on the land. And I think, although George certainly felt insecure about that in later years, it also gave him a very kind of ready, rough and ready approach to education. He was not afraid to be self-taught. And all of those skills really stood him up well when he became a surveyor and when he became even a military man and a general. He knew how to do things in a very practical way.
Right. I want to read one paragraph that's one of my favorites in the whole book. You write this about young George. Native self-awareness carefully cultivated allowed him to visualize both his strengths, such as his tremendous memory and capacity for hard work, and his deficiencies, such as his irritable temper. Such habits constituted a recipe for self-improvement that would reach perfection in the oven of ambition. From his mother and the entrepreneurial society of his day, George acquired an abiding ambition to improve himself. But he also developed, perhaps from Lawrence, a dreamer's sense of the possible. A recently discovered picture that he may have drawn as a teenager depicts a sailing ship of the type that plied the tobacco trade, a symbol of American commerce and hopes of prosperity. Washington spent his youth training to become a self-made man.
Yeah, I mean, that to me encapsulates, when I've studied Washington more and more, I think his greatest quality was his ability to see himself as he was. That is, you don't get carried away with try to see yourself as you wish you were, but you take yourself as you are, and then you try to focus on improving and becoming better and working on that. So I just think that's central to his character.
Absolutely. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Edward G. Lengel, author of First Entrepreneur, How George Washington Built His and the Nation's Prosperity. One facet of George Washington's life that I don't remember ever hearing about or knowing about was the work that he did as a surveyor. And mean, it's interesting work that I think most of us don't understand at all. And moreover, I think we not only don't remember that George Washington did such work, but also until your book would have no understanding of how that would have served him well. Just say a word about the work that he did as a surveyor and why it is significant for us to acknowledge this this experience which he had.
Well, he got his job as a surveyor through his connections with the Fairfax family, again, thanks to Lawrence. And it gave him, first of all, that kind of first job experience that many of us have, but unlike for many of us, it was a positive experience. He learned how to earn a wage on his own. He learned how to save money. He used his earnings from his surveyor's business to buy land and to improve that land. I think, though, that thanks to the Fairfaxes, in teaching him as a surveyor, he learned to see not just the richness of the land as it was, but he learned to see its potential. Because I think that entrepreneurship for him, as for others, is not just like looking for the piles of gold that are sitting there waiting to be taken, but to see the potential in something that may not look immediately like a prospect. He saw the potential in the land and how it could become rich.
And you mentioned that in the summer of 1752, George's half-brother Lawrence dies, we believe, from tuberculosis. And this ended up changing George's life in some respects when he was, I believe, just, well, he would have been about 20 years old. So describe what life is like for George at the relatively tender age of 20.
Well, he's still surveying. He has lost. He went to Barbados with his brother to see if he could find a cure, and certainly was bedazzled by what he saw there in the Caribbean. In fact, we are just editing George's Barbados diary, where he writes about what it's like to go to the Caribbean. So he's certainly amazed by that. But he's also really downcast and upset at Lawrence's illness. George catches smallpox when he's in Barbados, and they say down in Barbados that they saved the American Revolution, because since George got smallpox there, he was immune from it later on as commander-in-chief of the army, which is certainly true. But then George has to come back to Virginia. Lawrence dies shortly thereafter. George is trying to wrap up his surveying, so he's certainly upset about Lawrence's passing, but at the same time, it's thanks to Lawrence's death that George eventually inherits Mount Vernon after Lawrence's wife and young daughter die as well. Mount Vernon comes to George as a direct inheritance.
Right. So you write, George, still only 20 years old, now held possession of some 4,291 acres. This brought him firmly within the ranks of the Upper Virginia gentry. What's really intriguing is how not too long thereafter, in the fall of 1753 into early 1754, George Washington ends up going on something of an adventure, which proves to be one of the most formative experiences of his early life, in which he learned a lot about himself, including some of his own deficiencies, which would help, in a sense, pave the way for the crucial leadership role which he would play a few years later in the Revolutionary War. Explain to our listeners about this expedition which George Washington led.
Well, he has to go all the way out through the wilderness to the far frontier into what is now western Pennsylvania and the Ohio to go and find a French fort and tell the French commander that in the name of the governor of Virginia, I want you to leave this place, to leave the Ohio Valley. And then he has to bring the French commander's response all the way back to Williamsburg, Virginia. It's pretty similar to being dropped by helicopter up in the Himalayas today and told to make contact with a local tribesman when you don't have any idea whether they're going to be your friends or they're going to kill you. So certainly it's something that takes a whole lot of bravery on George's part to carry out this mission. He's still quite young. He's very naive. It shows multiple times during the expedition. He's afraid that the Indians are after him, that they're going to kill him, and he's practically in a panic on the way home. But he also shows tremendous endurance and decisiveness. And he learns what it's like to lead men. It's one of the most dramatic, exciting episodes in his life.
I especially appreciated this observation that you make, because this helps us understand something of what he learned through that experience that I think is not quite obvious to the rest of us. You write, "Military service is a social equalizer. In civilian life, Washington would have had nothing to do with the plebs, farm laborers, dock workers, drifters, and immigrants fresh off the boat who enlisted in his regiment. But circumstances now forced him to confront the basic realities that encompassed their daily lives. He learned about the hardships that a day's lost pay or going without a meal, hardly gentlemen's concerns, could impose on common folk. He was not without empathy, and became their advocate. To a degree, he shared their hardships." And of course, when we think about what is going to face him through the Revolutionary War years, we can understand how this is a very important quality for someone like Washington to develop.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of representative of the way that Washington learned to tackle any big task that he was faced with. Whether it was something on the farm, whether it was leading the army or becoming a president, he didn't just kind of stand back and look at it from a distance, but he would plunge into it all the way down and study it and try to understand how it worked on the fundamental level. So when he becomes a military commander in the French and Indian War, he really forces himself to learn how the men and how the officers live and to discover what's important to them. He doesn't so much, it's not as if he hops off his horse and is palling around with the private soldiers, but he does study them and interact with them and try to understand them. And he learns that a commander, whether a military commander or a manager, ignores those types of basic fundamentals at his peril.
Mm. As you describe this chapter of Washington's life, that is his participation in the conflict which came to be known as the French and Indian War, you mention in particular a dramatic day on July 9th, 1755, when General Braddock suffered what you describe as a catastrophic defeat. And Washington really demonstrates great heroism in rallying the troops and leading them away to safety in the wake of what was a very much unanticipated disaster. I find it intriguing that you describe this experience as both educational and traumatic. And chances are a lot of experiences like this that one might experience are going to have sort of both of those qualities.
It was on that day that Washington became, in effect, a combat veteran. And I think that that is a fundamental aspect of his character for the rest of his life. He is on the field with a British force commanded by General Edward Braddock. They're attacked by French and Indians on multiple sides. The force collapses. Within a short period of time, Washington is the only leading officer on that field who has not been either killed or wounded. And so the responsibility comes on him to take the entire army of British and American troops under his control and lead them off the field. And he wrote later on that he would never forget that night and the cries of the wounded. Washington himself had four horses shot out from under him. He had bullet holes all through his jacket. and his cap. And I think that that gave him a broadness of perspective and an understanding really of what war is about. I'm not arguing that it traumatized him, but I think it gave him a special wisdom about warfare and about men, what they do under pressure, of the type that really only veterans have. And it was something that made him who he was.
And it's interesting also that you tell us that it's really in this period that Washington also came to understand that success ultimately depended on money. Even the littlest tasks reinforced this basic fact. And of course, this is going to prove to be an inescapable reality when it comes to the Revolutionary War just a few years later.
That's right, and he will come to use the phrase that money is the sinews of war, that it's really what makes an army function.
We're speaking with Edward G. Lengel about his book, First Entrepreneur, How George Washington Built His and the Nation's Prosperity. We need to talk for a moment about something that signals a dramatic new chapter in George Washington's life as a rising entrepreneur, namely his marriage to one Martha Dandridge Custis. It's important for us to know who she was and her exceptional social standing at the time that these two met and ultimately married.
She was, like George Washington's mother, Mary, a woman of great character, a woman who was intelligent, who was a good manager, and who was strong-minded. And we too often kind of, when we look at Martha, we say, oh, well, she was very rich, and George swept her away, and then he had all kinds of fun with her money, and she went off into the corner to knit. And that's completely, completely unfair. Because, of course, she chose him as well, and she chose him partly because he was such a good manager, and they both worked together to steward both her wealth and his wealth. They were great partners. They were in love with each other and remained so to the end of their lives. And really, it was that partnership, I think, that came to be the foundation of George's career.
I especially love the moment when you described early in their marriage, the first months there at Mount Vernon, how George Washington established habits that would literally last a lifetime. Can you just kind of talk us through those daily habits, the daily rituals of George Washington there at Mount Vernon? I find this fascinating.
Yeah, he was a man who lived by, I hesitate to use the word routine, but he had certain ways of doing things, of how he would get up and dress carefully, take stock of the day, and understand what needed to be done. He would mount his horse, he would ride around the estate, check up on everything that was going on, to see it in person, if necessary, to touch and hold it with his hands, whether it's a new plow or some new form of crops. And then he would come back to the estate, have breakfast, and return to his study and write out farming reports, plans, procedures based on what he had seen and observed. He would meet with overseers. And, of course, he would set aside some time, we hope and assume, to interact with Martha and other members of the family, because he was a fairly sociable. He was not all business. And kind of continue that through the day. It was all about kind of immersing himself in the workings of the estate.
You tell us that George Washington was very interested in innovative agricultural practices, and this is something that we see acted out over the course of decades. Describe the lengths to which George Washington went to sort of explore the most exciting possibilities of, for instance, raising crops there at Mount Vernon in the most efficient way possible. I mean, he was doing things that were uncommon for his day.
Yeah, and part of this was, again, because of his propensity for trying to understand things on the elemental level. He saw pretty quickly at Mount Vernon that the tobacco system that it was based on was inefficient, it was wasteful, and it would lead him, as it did many others, into debt, again, partly because of this British credit system. He studied, tried to learn about different crops, what they could do, what the results would be, and he decided to invest everything eventually in wheat. He changed over his entire estate in the mid-1760s to wheat almost all at once, which allowed him to sell on his own account, to grind high-quality flour, to turn the people on his estate who had been occupied with tobacco, which was very labor-intensive, into cultivating wheat, which gave them plenty of free time to become self-sufficient, to make their own clothing, to make their own shoes, their own ironwork, and to prepare their own food, to fish, develop the fisheries and other enterprises, and then to sell as well. So Mount Vernon became kind of an industry in of itself.
You also describe in intriguing fashion George Washington's attitude when it came to his own slaves. And this is an attitude which seemed to change a little bit, at least over the years. But particularly in the early years, you tell us that George Washington viewed his slaves primarily as commodities and yet also as personnel to be managed. And really for practical reasons as much as any sort of high-sounding humanitarian reasons, he tended to treat his slaves quite humanely, or as humanely as a slave can be treated. Can you say more about that?
Well, he certainly tried to avoid physical coercion as much as possible, as much as he thought was possible. And I'm not going to argue that somehow Washington was like a benevolent slaveholder. I don't know that there is such a thing. He tried to maintain whatever scraps of dignity he could in the process of owning and managing slaves, and to try to direct them, to try to give them motivations for doing what they were doing. But he always kind of foundered on the rocks of the basic problem that enslaved people cannot enjoy the fruits of their own labor. They have no real motivation to work. They will always do the minimum possible, and they will resist, as now people who study enslaved people at that time are seeing, that they were resisting in a thousand different little ways. And so I think that was eventually, over many years, what convinced Washington that slavery itself was a dead end. He thought that industry and morality were two sides of the same coin. If you reduce a person's motivation to be industrious, you demoralize them, you debase them, you corrupt them, and also that in turn corrupts the people who force them into that system. So I think it was basically the labor principle that turned him against slavery in the long run.
This is the period where Washington begins to develop his deepest resentment towards Great Britain for what he regarded as all kinds of unfair practices, which made the acquisition of wealth so much more difficult than it would otherwise be. And of course, ultimately that and other disputes eventually lead to out-and-out war for independence, and much of that story we know. I think one of the most interesting insights you shed about the way in which Washington led the army in the Revolutionary War, and ultimately thereafter as our first president, is when you say, as an adult, Washington attained a genius ideally suited to his own and his nation's future prosperity. Grand ideas counted for little, he understood, without a good deal of plain common sense. He realized ideas meant and could achieve nothing without close attention to the minute realities of day-to-day life. If the devil dwelt in the details, so did hope. We just have a couple of minutes left, but could you say a word about the way in which his leadership, both as Commander-in-Chief and then as our president, had the hallmarks of what you've just described there?
Well, it's remarkable with Washington that he came to identify his own prosperity and the nation's prosperity. That didn't mean so much that what was good for George was good for the nation, but it meant that he saw that the prosperity and the opportunity of the individual person or the individual entrepreneur was what eventually created the basis for prosperity for the entire nation. When he became president, in fact, right before he became president, he wrote a letter that I think is one of the most remarkable letters he ever wrote, in which he said, "To establish the national prosperity shall be my first and my only aim as president." He saw that ultimately that prosperity and that ability of people to work, to produce, and to better themselves was what would create the foundation of the United States. That kind of hope in the future, that ability to work with the details, that each individual worker out in the fields or in a workshop, wherever they may be, their ability to work and to enjoy the produce and to become better for themselves and their children was what would make this country great. He always saw those individual details that were so essential to success.
Mm. And of course, he had to live with the reality of the imperfections of this young nation, and had to do whatever he could to secure the greatest success possible. And we can read much more about the way he led our forces in the Revolutionary War and about both of his terms as our first president and much, much more in your fascinating book, again called First Entrepreneur, How George Washington Built His and the Nation's Prosperity, published by Da Capo Press. The author, Edward G. Lengel. Professor Lengel, I so enjoyed this book. It's one of the most interesting books I've read in a long, long time, and I hope many people will seek it out and enjoy it as I did. Thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. It was a great pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I will be speaking with Ray Forgiani and Melanie Hovey about Harbor Market and about hopes and dreams for future expansion. There'll be no Morning Show on Monday because of the 4th of July holiday, but we will have interesting morning shows for the rest of next week, including a conversation with the author of a much-discussed new novel called Kitchens of the Great Midwest, which explores some of the many ways in which food is an important vehicle for self-expression. Next week, we'll also be talking with the author of a book that explores some of the important ways in which we can live lives of purpose and meaning. Next week, we'll also include a preview of the next Secret Garden Walk in Kenosha, which you have the opportunity to explore some of the most beautiful hidden gardens in the city of Kenosha. Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street. Online at andreasgifts.com.